Chapter 3. A Rogue Elephant in the Agency Woods. Gustav Rakatos hadn't gone to Harvard. He didn't have important relatives or fancy summer vacations. He hadn't inherited tennis lessons, money, or classic good looks. He was the son of Greek immigrants from Aliquippa, Pennsylvania, and the CIA simply didn't go to places like that to recruit its elite case officers. Aliquippa was a steelworkers' town, and for most of its early years, the agency seemed to think its clandestine services should be filled with men of breeding. That's how the British had always picked their spies, and the founders of the CIA had taken the British as their model. British spies belonged to clubs. They dressed like gentlemen. Their top officers had gone to boarding schools, then cemented their friendships as young men at Oxford and Cambridge. This was a class that had been at the spy game for centuries. They had learned that a man's family and schools stood for something. That, at least, was the legend about the British. So it was natural, when Congress created the CIA in 1947, that the American leadership would look to the same class for its service. And, to a remarkable extent, the CIA did manage to fill its ranks with sons of the establishment. Take Theodore Roosevelt's grandson, Archie. Brilliant at Groton and Harvard, a classical scholar with 6 languages and a robust appetite for healthy adventure, he was one of the first generation of agency operatives. On the surface, he led a rather dull existence as a mid-level State Department officer. But everyone knew that Archie worked for the CIA, and there were few who didn't welcome an invitation to one of his elegant Georgetown evenings. There was always a sense at the Roosevelts of being at the center of things both past and present. As Archie's distant cousin, the columnist Stuart Alsop, used to joke at such gatherings, a man should have furniture, he shouldn't have to buy it. In Archie's house there were ancestral portraits on the wall, and that patrician glow that comes from the mix of old wood, oriental rugs, gleaming silver, and the kindly faces of faithful retainers. Archie presided effortlessly over these gatherings, actually thinking of them as informal because the dress called for dark suits instead of dinner jackets. There was little general conversation at the table. The ritual called for each man to speak first to the woman on his right, and then, at an appropriate moment, to turn and converse with the dinner partner on his left. It was not until after the women left the men to their cigars and brandy that the talk would turn to matters of state. Then Archie might talk about the latest rebellion of the Kurds, or what his friend the Shah of Iran was up to. But even here it was all terribly discreet. The agency would never have to worry about a Roosevelt being polygraphed. It was part of the noblesse oblige of the man to know intuitively how to keep a secret. No matter how long he served or how far he rose in the CIA, Gustav Rakatos would always feel a bit like the poor street kid, nose against the glass, looking in at the party, knowing he would never be asked to attend such gatherings. And dinner at Archie's was hardly the only thing that made Avrakatos feel like an outsider. "Almost everyone was a fucking blue blood in the CIA in 1961 when I came in," he says. "They were just beginning to let Jews move up that year, but there still weren't any blacks, Hispanics, or females. Just some token Greeks and Polacks." Some of Avrakatos's friends actually schemed to wangle an invitation to Archie's. They felt it could help just to be seen with this patrician. But Avrakatos hadn't kowtowed to the plant manager's sons in Aliquippa, and he wasn't afraid to say what he thought about the agency's blue bloods. As far as he was concerned, they operated in an old boys' network to keep his kind down, and the only reason half of them got anywhere is because they jerked off Henry Cabot Lodge's grandson at some prep school. Avrakatos had a chip on his shoulder, there was no question about that. But he did make friends with some of the agency's well-born officers, and he accepted the notion that some of the real aristocrats, originals like Roosevelt, were at least authentic. Nevertheless, as he rose through the ranks, he came to loathe a certain type of blue blood with a rage that bordered on class hatred. The CIA hadn't started opening its ranks to gifted new Americans like Avrakatos until 1960, and the move had had nothing to do with social justice. There were no quotas in those days. The fact was that these first-generation types, brought up on the streets of America and speaking the languages of the old country, had certain strengths that the CIA had come to feel it needed. A kind of panic about the communist threat had been sweeping over Washington. In every city in the 1950s, air raid sirens were regularly set off. Tens of millions of children got used to scurrying into bomb shelters or crawling under their desks as part of drills to prepare for a Soviet nuclear assault. In every corner of the globe, the dark hand of the communists was seen to be at work. The commission by which the CIA came to live during those years was spelled out in one telling paragraph from a blue ribbon panel explaining to President Truman why it was essential for the United States to abandon its traditional sense of fair play in this all-out struggle for the world. "It is now clear that we are facing an implacable enemy whose avowed objective is world domination. There are no rules in such a game. Hitherto acceptable norms of human conduct do not apply. If the United States is to survive, it must use more clever, more sophisticated, and more effective means than those used against us." It was almost as if Gustav Rakatos's early life in Aliquippa had been designed to turn him into the kind of back-alley spy that Harry Truman's advisors were urging the CIA to nurture and unleash on the communists. The one thing no one needed to teach this man was how to subvert and destroy his enemies. Aliquippa is one of those American company towns always described as a melting pot. Immigrants from all over the world poured in here for jobs in the huge steelworks that the Jones and Laughlin Company built. But the hard people of this steel town never lost any of their ethnic pride or their ethnic hatreds. You can still see the working man's anger in Avrakatos when he drives up the hill to Plan 6, where the WASP managers used to live in their 5- and 6-bedroom stone houses. He calls them cake eaters and talks about them with the same contempt he uses for the agency's blue bloods. When Jones and Laughlin moved into Aliquippa on the rolling hills just north of Pittsburgh, it didn't specify where the workers should live. But every ethnic group insisted on living, marrying, partying, and going to church with its own. As recently as 1980, 14,000 steel workers earned their living there. Today, it's as if the bomb had struck. There's nothing but great hulking iron forms and rusting steel. About the only sign of life are a few teams of workers dismantling one of the abandoned steel plants to sell as scrap to the Japanese. But Avrakatos remembers Aliquippa the way it was when he was growing up, and delegations of Japanese used to come in buses to study this marvel of industrial America. They brought movie cameras and notebooks to record everything about the workings of the largest integrated steel mill in the world. No one felt anything but pride as the plant operated at full tilt 24 hours a day, spewing out great clouds of pink and black smoke that would engulf the ethnic neighborhoods of Aliquippa. "That's Plan 7, where the Dagos lived," Avrakatos says, like a tour guide passing through the ruins of some past civilization. "Plan 12 was all Irish. The Polacks lived in Plan 5. Plan 11 is where the niggers were." For all his years at the CIA, Avrakatos has never stopped using the brutal street talk of his youth. He's as proud of it as he is of the scars that lace his body from teenage knife fights. "Each of the plans had a gang, and they fought like cats and dogs," he explains. "Each plan fought among itself, but when the niggers came, we all banded together. You had to be very fucking practical. The guys who made it out of Aliquippa had one thing in common. You can't fuck around all day trying to make up your mind. The niggers will overrun you." This kind of talk is very jarring, but it was the language of Aliquippa, and it shaped Avrakatos's brutal instinct for the jugular. There are legends in Aliquippa about the ones who escaped and made good. Henry Mancini, who got his start at the musical and political Italian clubs. Mike Ditka, Avrakatos's high school friend from Plan 7, the former Chicago Bears linebacker whose name is synonymous with toughness. Tony Dorsett of the Cowboys. Becoming a sports hero was one way out. The Mafia was another. There were 3,000 Sicilians in Aliquippa. Most of Avrakatos's friends were Sicilians, and he knew the Alamena family as men of honor. Gust's father, Oscar Avrakatos, distributed Rolling Rock beer for them, and they always treated the Avrakatoses with respect. But the Sicilian Mafia wasn't an option for a Greek American, and anyway, Oscar Avrakatos had high hopes for his son. Like many other immigrants, Oscar's American experience had begun at Ellis Island as an 8-year-old boy from the Greek island of Lemnos. He had come over with his brother in 1894 and for 3 decades toiled in the sweatshops of New England and the iron house of Aliquippa. But then Oscar broke away from the pack with a vision of making a fortune selling his own soda pop. With his hard-earned savings, he bought a bottling assembly line from the Smile and Cheer Up Company of St. Louis. He named his new company after the Greek sun god Apollo. Apollo was his good luck god, and he figured the name would win customers from the Greek Orthodox Church, not to mention workers in the mills.